few days ago, I received another email from a fellow who has been putting an enormous amount of time and energy into trying to correct all the errors in my understandings of God and to get me back on the orthodox straight and narrow. I have a fair bit of respect for this fellow because, unlike many of those who write to me to try and correct my heresies, he's been quite respectful and genuine in the way that he has engaged with my arguments and set out his own. Most of the others just scream at me and tell me that I'm going to hell and that I'm wrong and without ever actually engaging with anything I say. But this bloke is much better than that. But this week's email surprised me because of the way that it just wrote off someone else with an unqualified blanket condemnation. He said that he had discerned the influence of the Franciscan theologian Richard Rohr in my sermons, and he wanted me to warn me off him. And he sent me a list of no less than 7 online critiques of Richard Rohr's teachings and expressed the hope that they would be enough to warn me away from Rohr in the future and to cause me to reassess any of my ideas that might have rooted themselves into my own beliefs. It reminded me of Rod Quantock commenting on Andrew Bolt. He said that he had reluctantly realised that he actually needed Andrew Bolt because he didn't always have time to research everything for himself. So when time was tight, he could just check up on what Andrew Bolt had to say about something and then confidently think the opposite. My correspondent seemed to be implying that anything said by Richard Rohr is similarly automatically wrong. Now, as it happens, I do think that Richard Rohr's latest book has gone off the rails, but previously I've certainly been a fan. And I've met Richard Rohr, and in person, like in his books, he strikes me as a genuinely loving, gracious, compassionate, and prayerful person. His teachings have been healing, liberating, and life-giving for many people. A bit like Jesus, his views are divisive because others don't like them, not because he has been aggressive or rude towards his opponents. An hour or so after reading and pondering this email, I sat down again with the gospel reading for tonight to work out what I might preach from it. And I was immediately struck by the response of the Pharisees to the public acclaim over Jesus' miraculous healing of 2 blind people and a person who couldn't talk. They accused him of being in league with the devil. It's from the ruler of the demons that he gets the power to cast out demons, they said. This is actually one of 2 times in Matthew's gospel that the Pharisees make this same accusation. And it's the other one where Jesus responds in detail. On this occasion, he seems to more or less ignore it. Evidently, there are more important things to attend to than what the Pharisees might be thinking about him. So I'm not going to import Jesus' response from the other passage into this one. I just want us to pause for a moment and think about the nature of this accusation. And then, like Jesus, move on to what's next on his agenda. One of the things that we see in the healing stories that have been recorded about Jesus is how symbolic they are. They're told in a way that emphasizes them as symbols of something bigger. So there are lots of stories about Jesus opening the eyes of blind people, because so much of Jesus' teaching is trying to open our eyes to things that we don't see or understand. Last Sunday afternoon, Uncle Dan opened our eyes to a whole lot of things that we had not previously seen about the 10 Commandments. And when Jesus did the same sort of thing, the gospel writers would pair the story with the story of a healing of a blind person to illustrate what was going on, how eyes were being opened. there are also quite a few stories of Jesus healing mute people, because his teaching was also, it was not only opening eyes, but giving voice to the voiceless, giving the power to speak out to those who had previously been silenced. And tonight's passage contained both an opening eyes story and an opening mouth story. And so it's in response to Jesus opening people's eyes and giving a voice to those who have been silenced that the Pharisees object and accuse him of being in league with the devil. A bit like my email correspondence assessment of Richard Rohr, they're saying, he's not one of us, and his teaching doesn't agree with ours. In fact, it sometimes is undermining ours. Therefore, he must be on the other side. He must be in league with the devil. This is actually an example of one of the things that Richard Rohr has often spoken about, dualistic thinking. Thinking that everything can be simply divided up into good and bad, right and wrong, our side and the devil's side. As soon as the Pharisees find themselves feeling opposed to Jesus, they instinctively think in terms of opposing sides. If we're on different sides, then one of those sides must be bad and wrong, and it can't be us, so it must be him. He must be in league with the devil. You can see how this thinking works. When we think in absolutes, it becomes impossible to imagine that God might be working in and through those who are not 100% on the side that we regard as good and right. And so instead of imagining that a compassionate and merciful God might be reaching out to us through a thoroughly flawed and frequently mistaken person, we divide the world up into those who are blessed by God and those who are condemned and cursed by God. And therefore, if we are sure of our own correctness and a Jesus or a Richard Rohr teaches something different, then we write them off as dangerous heretics who must be in league with the devil. Our dismissal is absolute. I have significant misgivings about Richard Rohr's latest book. Does that mean that I think he's now in league with the devil? No, it does not. Does it mean that I think that God will no longer use his writings and teachings to bring healing, hope, and freedom to anybody? No, it doesn't. It doesn't even mean that I don't think God will use this book. God is outrageously merciful and astonishingly creative. God can even take an abominable evil like the crucifixion and work through it to bring healing, mercy, hope, and new life. So working through Richard Rohr, or even me, should be a piece of cake in comparison to that. So how does Jesus, on this occasion, respond to the accusation that he's in league with the devil? Well, the very next verse says, then Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in the synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and curing every disease and every sickness. In other words, his only response was to go right on doing exactly what he had been doing when they made the accusation. Then it goes on to say that when Jesus saw the crowds, he had compassion for them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. This is a fairly pointed statement by the gospel writer because, of course, the Pharisees saw themselves as the designated shepherds of the people. So if Jesus is saying that the people are like sheep without a shepherd, then he is seeing their religious leaders as asleep at the wheel, and he's stepping into the breach. But Jesus doesn't step into the breach alone. In his compassion for these lost and leaderless people, he says to his disciples, to us, the harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, ask the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. Now that's the end of what we heard tonight, but right after that, Jesus calls together his closest 12 followers and for the first time gives them authority to teach, heal and liberate as he himself has been doing. And he sends them out to do just that on his behalf. And if any of you have any doubts about whether God would call and send people who haven't got their theology straight or their act together, then just read some stories of these 12 disciples and how much of the time they had Jesus tearing his hair out over their thick-headedness and their total misunderstanding of him. But in order to segue from this into the blessing of the school children, which we'll be doing in just a few minutes, I want to conclude by thinking about the connection between that and this idea of praying for and being the laborers who God sends into a world in which a world in need of better leaders, better examples. If the world in which Jesus moved left people feeling like sheep without a shepherd, look at the world in which these young people are growing up in today. The failure of leadership among our political leaders has been big news for the past month or so. And the monumental failures of institutional church leadership have been making us all cringe for years. This little congregation in this little place can't fix all that. We can play our part, but the issues are not all within our sphere of immediate influence. But these young people are in our sphere of immediate influence, and they badly need to see the faith lived out in community with compassion and mercy and genuine all-inclusive love. They will see plenty of examples of corrupt and self-serving leadership, but they need a place where they can find mentors and friends and examples who will model for them lives of ongoing growth in faith, integrity, and love. We are called to be that place and those people. And we are called to pray to the Lord of the harvest for the courage and the nous to do it well, and also for more good people to be sent to join us in modelling this life for these youngsters. And at the heart of modelling that life is a practice of mercy and compassion that creates space for others to share the task, even when we don't agree with everything that they do or say. We want these youngsters to learn to recognise the grace of God wherever it might be seen and whoever it might be seen in. Because our hope and our prayer for them is that they will truly be and be seen to be followers of Jesus. And Jesus did not say that his followers would be known by their defence of orthodoxy and their passion for correcting errors. He said that his followers would be known by and for their love.